this sounds like art.
Art.
Art. Art and his take on it.
I'm an artist of liberation.
Everybody wants to be an artist.
Art history.
Art history.
The making of art.
Art history with Lorraine Kipiotis.
Tonight we are off back in time for our look at art history with Lorraine Kipiotis. Well, we usually do go back in time. We're going a lot further back in time tonight to look at ancient art and some of the most important pieces that have been discovered and their influence on later artists. Now, when I say ancient, I'm talking about some of the artworks that came out of ancient Roman Greece and were discovered buried in fields or in other strange places. Lorraine's from the National Art School and our regular art history guest. Hi, Lorraine. Welcome back.
Hi, Suzanne. It's good to be here.
So you've got five specific pieces of ancient art that we're going to talk about. What are they?
Yeah, look, there were so many to choose from and I'm sure everyone has their favourites. But I'm going to talk a little bit about a piece called the Laocoon and the Apollo Belvedere, the Belvedere Torso, and a couple of Venuses as well that are very important, I think, and important in everyone's imagination.
So why are these pieces considered so important? Why have you picked these ones?
Well, I think there's this great Western tradition of art in sort of the belief of the classical ideal of beauty that comes to us from antiquity, from ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and via the Renaissance, of course. And it's this real focus on the harmony, beauty, and the proportions, human proportions of statues. And during the Renaissance, of course, as many people know, there was a real rebirth of interest in humanism and in classical art. So we see a lot of these statues coming through, and a lot of the ancient forms that actually the Romans used were revived during the Renaissance, such as the freestanding nude statue. I'm sure a lot of people have heard about Donatello's nude David, for example, and of course Michelangelo's David, but also things like the portrait bust and the equestrian statue that the Romans tended to do a lot of, that the Renaissance artists rediscovered. So from that, then, that went through and influenced more modern artists.
So there's this real sort of harking back to the forms used in ancient art during the Renaissance.
Yeah.
So, and a number of artists were influenced, weren't they, by these pieces?
Oh, look, absolutely. Because as you said in your intro, Suzanne, a lot of these pieces were found just sort of buried in, fields and vineyards. And what really fascinates me is not necessarily when they were made, although that is important, but when they were unearthed and how they influenced. So, for example, a piece like the Laocoon that I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment was unearthed in 1506. So it really influenced someone like Michelangelo. But the Venus de Milo, for example, they didn't find that until 1820. So Michelangelo and the Renaissance artists would have had no idea of the Venus de Milo, but the later artists of the 19th century and 20th century did.
Lorraine Kipiotis is here. Okay, so what is the Laocoon exactly?
Oh, well, that's a great question because it's a strange name. It's actually the name of a Trojan priest, the Laocoon. The full name of full title of the piece is the Laocoon and his two sons. And basically it's a huge statue. It's monumental. The figures are nearly life-size. It's about 2 metres high and over 2 metres wide. And it shows the Trojan priest Laocoon and his two sons being strangled by a sea serpent. Now, it takes place during the Trojan War, and the priest was a Trojan, of course, but he tried to warn the Trojans against accepting the Trojan horse, the Greeks' gift to them. Poseidon, who was on the side of the Greeks, because all of the gods took sides in this war, Poseidon, who was really angry then at Laocoon for warning the Greeks, sent a sea serpent out to kill he and his son. And it also shows quite pivotally that, when the gods want to punish you, they not only punish you, they punished his sons as well, who were fairly innocent, thereby sort of wiping out his entire line from then on.
So it's a big statue. When and where was it discovered?
Okay, so it was discovered in Rome, actually in the vineyard, in a vineyard near the Church of Santa Maria Maggiore in 1506. And Pope Julius, who I think we've spoken about before, who's a great classical enthusiast, was informed of the fact. So he gathered his court artists, which included Michelangelo. He was there doing the Sistine Chapel ceiling at the time, and called him to have a look at it. So Michelangelo was actually present when they took it out of the ground. And I mean, how amazing would that have been to actually see this incredible statue? And it's full of dynamism. Its emotional intensity is so focused in this piece that it really, really influenced Michelangelo's work.
Yeah. And they would have immediately had an idea of how old it would have been.
Oh, yes, yes. They actually recognised it from what it was from a description of from the ancient Roman writer Pliny had actually described this statue. And he'd said that it was then in the palace of Titus, the Emperor Titus, and he attributed it to three Greek sculptors, Agesander, Athenodorus and Polydorus from Rhodes. So they knew what it was straight away. So it was, you know, famous.
Isn't that wonderful? Already famous. Yeah. And then suddenly it's dug up in 1506 and Michelangelo, as you say, comes along and he would have been wide-eyed at looking at this. How did it then influence his work?
Oh, well, look, Suzanne, if you look at the work that he did prior to this, you know, something like his David, which is very calm, very composed. It's a lot of, you know, withheld tension. And then you look at, and very classical, but then you look at the work that he did afterwards, especially in the Sistine Chapel ceiling, and you look at his nude figures there or his male figures, they're full of emotional intensity. Or even, for example, his bound and his dying slave that he did for Pope Julius's tomb, the unfinished tomb. There, you know, there's also that incredible twisting of the body, the musculature that was, you know, prominent in the Laocoon that we can now see in Michelangelo's work.
That hadn't emerged otherwise in Renaissance art?
No. Look, prior to that, work was quite, I said, you know, sort of classical, so which was very, very calm. And that ideal, the very Greek ideal of the combination of both mind and body working together, whereas something like the Laocoon was very Hellenistic, which was a period that came after the classical era and, again, full of emotional intensity and drama. And that's what we see happening in Michelangelo's work then.
Lorraine Kipiotis from the National Art School is with you. You're on Nightlife with Suzanne Hill. We're talking about some of the most important pieces of ancient art in our look at art history tonight. So obviously the Laocoon influenced Michelangelo's sculptures. Were there other sculptures that influenced Michelangelo?
Oh, look, absolutely. Ones that he already knew of. There was the Belvedere torso, which is actually just a fragmented work. It's just a truncated torso, basically. And again, very, very muscular of a, you know, a dynamic and muscular male form, as well as the Apollo Belvedere, which was a beautiful classical statue of the god. We think now it was a Roman copy of an original Greek statue, but beautiful nonetheless and heralded for many, many centuries as the most ideal statue of classicism. And it's interesting also, Suzanne, you know, I've referred to these both as the Belvedere torso and the Apollo Belvedere, and often they're named, the statues are named according to where they're actually displayed. So both of these statues belonged to the Vatican and they were displayed in the Belvedere Gardens. And now, of course, you can see them in the Vatican Museums.
Ah, okay. And so Michelangelo's Head of Jesus Christ in the Last Judgment, you think was influenced too by the Apollo Belvedere?
Yes, 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 absolutely. It was a later discovery and Michelangelo by this time was doing the Last Judgment painting in the Sistine Chapel and he really uses that profile of the Apollo Belvedere in his figure of Jesus Christ. So he gives him a real sort of a very classical look about him.
And so these two, the Belvedere torso and the Apollo Belvedere, when were they uncovered?
Oh, look, they were uncovered in the late 1400s, early 1500s. So, you know, again, there would have been a lot of artists, you know, influenced by them. Yeah. But of course, you know, Rome, a lot of artworks in Rome especially would have been in situ for millennia. And, you know, someone like Michelangelo who arrives in Rome and, you know, sees the amazing works in the Forum, for example, was also very much influenced. You know, he uses, for example, the figure of a river god in one of the arches in the Forum as one of the figures of Christ's ancestors in the ceiling as well. So we're getting these little sort of notes coming through from ancient art all the way through.
So the Renaissance artists were already surrounded in a way by ancient art and this was just more and more of it coming to light.
Yeah. And especially in Italy too, because you've got to remember there was still remnants of classical art in Italy, unlike somewhere in France or Germany or England. So there was a bit of a battle later on, you know, in terms of trying to get classical pieces of art, you know, even out of Italy for national collections.
So what others? I mean, I'm just thinking of time I went to Rome and I've seen all these sculptural heads of you know, for example, Cicero and emperors. That's all back dating back to actual Rome. Ancient Rome, isn't
yes.
it? So
it's all
there. Or it was. So who else was influenced by work like the Apollo Belvedere and the Belvedere torso?
Oh, okay. So look, I'm going to talk a little bit about the surrealists in the 20th century because they were very much influenced by classical works. Giorgio de Chirico, for example, uses the head of the Apollo Belvedere very prominently in his painting The Song of Love that he made in 1914. And even, you know, sort of closer to our own era, in 1972 during the Apollo 17 moon landing mission, it was actually used, the head of the Apollo Belvedere was actually used quite prominently on the official logo of that particular mission.
Yeah, Apollo kept cropping up quite a lot, didn't it?
Yeah.
Everything named after the gods. So the Apollo Belvedere then, it had quite a history, didn't it?
Incredibly. You know, I mentioned that other countries in Europe really wanted to have classical and, you know, ancient statues for their own collection. And it was stolen along with many other works by Napoleon Bonaparte. So Napoleon came in with his troops sometime around, you know, 1796. And he actually took art connoisseurs with him on this trip to basically confiscate some of the greatest works that they'd seen. So they took the Apollo Belvedere. So it went down into, you know, up to France for a while, along with many other incredible statues. And they were sent back, of course, you know, Waterloo happened, Napoleon lost out, and they were all repatriated by about 1815, 1816.
Lorraine, once he'd taken the Belvedere, it went on display at the Louvre, I think.
The Belvedere went back to Italy, but he'd also taken a number of other works, including the Venus de Medici that I'll talk about in a moment. But what's really important is quite soon after all of these works were returned to Italy, the French actually made a deal to have the Venus de Milo brought to the Louvre. Now, the Venus de Milo was actually discovered in Greece in about 1820.
On the island of Milos.
On the island of Milos. That's exactly right, yeah. Because that's what the name means. Venus de Milo doesn't mean that a guy named Milo or Milo made her. It means that she came from the island of Milo or Melos in Greece. So she was discovered there, and the French made a deal with the government there, and I think they ended up buying it for the equivalent of, you know, 1,000 francs at the time, which, you know, would have bought maybe a nice herd of goats. So they got a good deal. They got a great deal there.
Now, you reckon, Lorraine, that the Venus de Milo is perhaps the most famous antique sculpture of all and maybe even the second most famous work of art in the world, although we talked about this last time and I don't think it cropped up in about the top three or four that we mentioned.
No, well, it's interesting because we tended to talk about paintings last time and, you know, paintings like the Mona Lisa, the Last Supper, you know, they're very much, when everyone mentions it, you can actually picture it in your mind. But I think the Venus de Milo is probably one of the most famous sculptures of antiquity. And certainly in the Louvre, you know, they say that when you go to the Louvre, for you to check out every single work in the Louvre would take you eight, if you take 8 hours a day to look at them, it would take you 3 months to look at every single work.
So and how long would you be spending in front of each work?
Oh, I reckon 3 seconds, you know, max. And that's the time that most people do spend in front of artworks in large museums because you try and get to see the big hitters.
Yeah.
And I remember myself, Suzanne, when I first went in my 20s to the Louvre, I'd met a bunch of Americans, young American students, and they had their tick list, their bucket list, and they said, come on, we're going to the Louvre, we're going to have a look at some of the major works. And I went, sure, I love art, you know. And it was literally the Nike of Samothrace, tick, the Mona Lisa, tick, the Venus de Milo, tick. And I'm like, no, wait, I want to stand in front and I actually want to look at it. No, no, we don't have time. We've got to keep moving.
That's right, we've done it.
We've done
one
it.
One more to you
it's
want.
Tick, yeah.
Oh, dear. But, so how long have you spent just on a side track at the Louvre?
Oh, gosh, I spent days in the Louvre. I once actually had the very good fortune to have a residency in Paris for 3 months, and I bought myself a pass to the Louvre. And I used to go there every day, but literally just to look at one or two works every day rather than try and take everything in because you can just become overwhelmed and exhausted by looking at works.
And are there still parts of it you haven't explored properly that you want to?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Something as huge as that, you just need to go back time and time again.
Mm. Lorraine Kipiotis from the National Art School, your art historian here on Nightlife, is here with you. Suzanne Hill with you on this Saturday night on Nightlife. Now, let's actually talk about the Venus de Milo there and what she actually is.
Oh, okay. Well, she's obviously the goddess Venus. But what was interesting was that she was found in two pieces. So a lot of people don't notice because they do sort of, you know, glaze over it quite quickly. But if you look really carefully, it's been the two halves meet in a line that's somewhat concealed by the roll of drapery around the goddess's hips. So they found these two pieces. Her arms were missing. And there was a lot of contention during the 19th century as to should we restore her, because arms were found at the same site, but they didn't fit the statue. So there was a lot of discussion as, okay, is she, does do her arms, you know, hold an apple, which is a symbol of Venus? Are they sort of wrapped around Ares, her lover? Ares or Mars? Is she leaning on a plinth? They couldn't agree as to what her arms were doing. So in the end, they decided that they would display it without arms. And it's a decision that still stands.
Now, you said it was sort of instantly recognised as a masterpiece. How so and why?
Well, I think it was almost complete, as I said, in two halves. There were parts of it that were a little damaged, but essentially it was recognised for the, you know, the classical masterpiece that was made at the time. And, you know, the French were just so glad to have a piece like that in their own museum.
And do they know who created it?
Look, there's some contention. There was another piece, a plinth also found nearby that had the name of an artist on it, but there's still contention as to whether it was that sculptor that made her. So the French at first wanted to attribute her to one of the more famous sculptors of antiquity, someone like Praxiteles or Phidias or Lysippos, to give it, a bit of fame, actually, to have people come to the Louvre. But they needn't have done that. It just grew and grew in popularity.
Yeah. So who has she inspired?
Oh, look, I think so many artists. Very soon after she came into the Louvre, I think Eugène Delacroix, the great French romantic painter, saw her, and I really think he used her. I think he used a combination of the Venus de Milo and the Nike of Samothrace for his figure of Liberty, Liberty leading the people in his beautiful painting. And it's very much a source of inspiration and a symbol of the French Revolution and of France itself. So you've got artists basically from that, you know, from that very moment that she was exhibited, looking at her. And then, you know, again, if we skip forward in time, we've got the surrealists again. Salvador Dali really explored that intersection of the classical and the surreal elements in his work. And he made a sculpture which he called the Venus de Milo with drawers in 1936. And it was what he called an anthropomorphic cabinet. So it was a half-size plaster reproduction of the famous statue, but altered with pom-pom decorated drawers at her forehead, her breasts, her stomach and her left knee that actually opened and closed. And he refers back to what influenced him, apart from the Venus de Milo here, to the work of Sigmund Freud. And there's a lovely quote, Suzanne. He said, "The only difference between the immortal Greece and the contemporary times is Sigmund Freud, who discovered that the human body is full of secret drawers that only the psychoanalyst is capable of opening."
Wow. And then Dali of representing in art by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
Now, what about René Magritte?
Oh, yeah, just before him, actually, René Magritte also made a sculpture. He painted her many times, but he made a sculpture called Les Menottes de Cuivre, which means the copper handcuffs, back in 1931. And he made his sculptured version, and it has a white head, a flesh-coloured body, blue drapery and a black pedestal. But he asked André Breton, who was, you know, an important force within the Surrealist group, to help him find a title for the work. And André Breton, in true Surrealist style, picked a title that really didn't have, you know, was quite idiosyncratic, had nothing to do with it. He said, "Let's call it the Copper Handcuffs."
Okay.
So why not? Why not?
Then there's Jim Dine. Who was he?
Yeah, okay. Well, Jim Dine, more of a pop artist. He really came to prominence in New York during the late 50s and 60s. And whilst he didn't really align himself with any of the major art movements of the time, he uses everyday objects and symbols in his work, like, you know, tools, hearts, bathrobes, skulls, and Venus de Milo. And in 1990, he created three tremendous sculptures of the Venus de Milo that he set in a water pool at, I think, on the corner of 6th Avenue and 53rd Street in Manhattan. And it's actually called Looking Toward the Avenue. So he's really trying to bring this idea of the classic aesthetics to a very modern Midtown Avenue and invites us really to look to the past, but connecting it to the present.
Are they still there?
Yeah, I believe they are.
Oh, okay. Mm. So they're part of the New York landscape now. Lorraine Kibiotis is here. We're doing art history on nightlife. Now, the other famous Venus, the Venus de Medici, also left a big influence on a lot of artists throughout history. What's the Venus de Medici?
Okay, the Venus de Medici, obviously called because she was owned by the Medici family during the Renaissance. Again, she was found in the area of the Baths of Trajan, and it would have been quite a suitable statue for a bath. And when I talk about a bath, I'm not just talking about your little bathtub in your bathroom. I'm talking about a huge, huge edifice that had, you know, the cold baths, the tepid baths, the warm baths, place where people met, baths for women, for men. And she would have been a statue.
Like the Bath in England?
Yeah, yes, yes, exactly, okay. Like the Roman baths in England. And in Bath, in fact. And she is a statue of the Venus, but a Venus, what's called a Venus pudica. And she's basically caught in the act of instinctively covering her breasts with one arm and her pubic area with the other, as though she's just been looked at by someone, as though she's just come out of a bath and not covered herself with a towel yet, but someone's looking at her, so she's trying to cover up. So you've got this sort of sensation of almost modesty, but also this titillating factor because you're looking at someone, you know, coming out of a bathtub, essentially.
Yeah. Now, so I heard she was once brightly coloured.
Yes. Now, this is the amazing fact, Suzanne, and what we don't realise a lot when we're looking at sculpture, because over the millennia, they've become quite worn and restored at sometimes, and a lot of the paintwork has been taken off them. But a lot of marble statues were polychromed. They were brightly coloured. Now, they did a restoration on her, the Venus de Medici, in 2012, and they realised that her hair had been gilded in gold,
oh, wow,
that her lips had been painted in cinnabar red. There were still traces of Egyptian blue on her, you know, the jewellery that she had worn, and her skin would probably have been coloured in a flesh colour as well.
Oh, that's incredible. Okay, so and now can you see the Venus de Medici today?
Yes, 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 yes. She actually went in around 1677 to the Uffizi, which were then the offices of the Medici family, and she was put in the Tribuna, which is the focus, the octagonal room, one of the most important rooms in the Uffizi, and she's still there today. So you can actually still go and see her today.
But this was another one that Napoleon had nicked off with for a while.
Oh, yes, 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 another one. You know, it was amazing, the stuff that he took back to France. I mean, I hear stories sometimes of having his art connoisseurs cut oil paintings out of their frame, fold them up and put them in their saddlebags to take back to France.
Wow. And yet the funny thing is, you say he wasn't actually that big an art fan. He just knew it was valuable.
No, no, he just knew it was valuable. I mean, for example, when he displayed the Apollo Belvedere and people would come to see him, he would stand next to the Apollo Belvedere, the beautiful classical statue, so people would admire both he and the Apollo Belvedere and compare them both together.
I know which one I think give a more favourable tick mark to, yeah. Now, look, we've got the Venus de Medici. Now, probably the most famous artist who was inspired by her was Botticelli.
Yes, yes. If you think about his beautiful Birth of Venus, she's actually standing in the
which
same pose.
She's in the Uffizi, isn't
it? And she's in the Uffizi as well. She's standing in the same pose as the Venus de Medici. And, you know, she embodies that beautiful grace, that modest pose, you know, and it adds very much to that gracefulness, the classical grace to Botticelli's artwork, but also shows us that mythology had really become a new genre to explore at that time as well.
Mm. Now, I like this. There was an Australian performance artist who was influenced very much by the Venus de Milo, which we're going back to now.
Yes, yes. Pansy Montague. She was amazing. She was actually known, her stage name was the Modern Milo, or sometimes simply La Milo. And what she did was she performed around the turn of the century. She started, I think she made a stage debut in 1898. She was a chorus girl then. But by 1905, she devised this incredibly novel and very unique act that would move her out of the chorus line and make her a headline performer. She performed under the pseudonym The Modern Milo, and what she did was that she would pose as classical statues, including the Venus de Milo and the Venus de Medici. And so, you know, by 1905, in her heyday here in Australia, she'd performed at the Melbourne Opera House and then the following months at the Sydney Tivoli Theatre.
So this is the forerunner of those people you might see at Circular Quay or some other place today pretending to be a famous statue. Was she the first to sort of do
Well, she wasn't the first. It's a tradition that goes right back to, well, for example, Lady Hamilton in England in the late 18th century would perform for, you know, a select group of her husband's friends in this sort of almost body stocking, you know, costume as classical statues. And then you've got, you know, a whole lot of performers in England. I think in around 1836, there was a troupe of male performers who had a whole repertoire of doing, you know, the Dying Gladiator, the Fighting Gladiator, the Apollo Belvedere, the Discobolus. And they were dressed in what was described as, you know, clothed head to foot in a tight outfit that resembled marble. But certainly, Pansy Montague, La Milo, became so famous she actually went and performed in London to crowds as big as 50,000 people.
And I'm just reading that she went into the Coventry pageant dressed as Lady Godiva and paraded 6 miles through the streets of Coventry on horseback.
Yes.
Oh, I love it.
Which would have been quite daring, you know, in 1906.
Yeah, that's right. And so those statue people we see today are very direct descendants of this trend as well. So of the pieces we've talked about tonight, Lorraine, which is your favourite?
Oh, my gosh, that's a hard question. I actually quite love the Venus de Medici because she's life-size. She's about my height, so I identify with her. And we actually have a marble copy of her at the National Art School.
Really?
That was once in the Botanic Gardens here in Sydney. So a lot of people who have been obviously to the Botanic Gardens in Sydney can still identify. There's a few statues there like Canova's beautiful boxes that were also neoclassical statues based on the, you know, the ancient ideal. But a lot of those statues, there was a bit of a wowser period, and a lot of the nude statues were taken out of the Botanic Gardens and some of them were given to the National Art School. So I can look at her every day, which is really lovely.
Oh, Lorraine, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about ancient art and, well, the way that modern artists have been influenced by it.
Thanks, Suzanne.
And it's Lorraine Kipiotis from the National Art School, our regular art history correspondent here on Nightlife.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.